As we begin this morning, I need to begin with a clarification and a correction from something I said last week. If you remember, when we read the passage from Colossians 1, 3 through 6, where the Apostle Paul said that the gospel had gone out through the whole world, he used the word world. I defined that word for Paul as meaning the whole Roman Empire. I said that the civilized world was the Roman Empire. Now, I do believe that Paul was probably thinking of the area that he knew. I doubt that Paul knew that Candace was the queen in Ethiopia and that there was a civilization down there. He might have known that. He might not have known that. I think it's reasonable that Paul was thinking of the world that he was familiar with, but we cannot say that the gospel had only gone into the what we call the civilized world. We shouldn't make the civilized world self-same as the Roman Empire, because there was civilization in other areas besides Rome. They may not have been Christianized yet, and we might not even know about them until later times, but there were civilizations such as the Parthian civilization. Now, this was the Parthian Empire before the time of Christ. Look at the whole spread. The Parthian Empire went from what Dr. Moffat calls Western Asia through Asia, through Eastern Asia. He says the phrase Middle East to refer to Palestine and Syria is a misnomer. That's not the Middle East. That's Western Asia. We call it the Middle East because we're Romanized and we're Mediterranean-centric, we're Eurocentric, and we think that everything revolves around Rome or revolves around the Mediterranean, so we think that way, and that is a wrong way of thinking. Now, we know that the church mainly spread in the Roman Empire, and we know that that's the focus, and that's what we'll have to study because that's what we know about and where the church was planted in its best expression. But the church did go to other areas. So I shouldn't equate the civilized world with the Roman Empire. That was incorrect. Okay? Now that the egg has been removed from part of the side of my face, let's begin this morning. This morning, lesson 5, we're going to discuss the persecution in the early church. Persecution in the early church. Now, when you bring up the subject of persecution, you're bringing up a subject that is as contemporary as it is old. If we're bringing up other subjects that we'll see in the early church where they hammered out certain doctrines, we find out that some of those issues are as contemporary as they are old, because we're still hammering on the doctrine of Christ. We're still hammering to an extent on the canon of Scripture. But certainly, there's nothing that we can refer back to in the history of the early church that is more real than the matter of persecution in the church today. Dr. Calhoun says it's reasonable to think that in the last 50 years there have been more people martyred for the cause of Christ than they were in the first 250 years of the life of the church. Two reasons for that. One, obviously our population in the world is so much greater. Therefore, 0.5% of persecution would affect more people than 30% of the persecution would have in the first, second, or third century. But the reality is, and we know the reality of that, and it has come home to us in the last month in a way that it has never had probably to any of you, and certainly not to me, with the death of R.F. and Kathy Kahn. We know living martyrs. We've touched them. We broke bread with them. We've prayed with them. That is a striking, striking thing. And it's not that rare, probably. It's that rare for us because we don't know what is going on in many situations. If we knew, it would not be as shocking to us, probably. As a sidelight, I remember John Piper talking about, they asked him what he did for his family devotions. And he was talking about the fact that he reads a daily thing with the children, and I forget what it's called, but it's like a current update of the situation of the church, and it makes reference to things. I think Voice of the Martyrs puts out something that's kind of somewhat current, where they're talking about what occurred last month or something like that. And he said he does that so that the children, his four boys who are grown, and Talitha, who's 11 years old now, would realize that the church has been and is being persecuted, and it's a serious thing. We don't play church. And beloved, these people did not play church. The period that we're talking about in church history, obviously, is the period of the early church. You could say the apostolic church, as we've said, extended up to about 100 A.D., then the early church for this chart we've taken up to about 450 A.D. The period that we're talking about extends from 30 A.D. at the beginning of the church as we know it up to the beginning of the rule of Constantine, which was 313. Persecution still continued heavily in the eastern part of the Roman Empire until about 320. So we're talking about a period of time that's about from 40, 33, 34, 39 A.D. up to about 312 to 320 A.D. Now, the first persecutions that you could expect, and we know from Scripture, was the persecution of the church by the Jews. This was to be expected, that the Jewish authorities would not react well to the message of Christianity. Pastor Merrick points out two things. He says the unbelieving Jews reacted in persecution first because the gospel, which inherently provokes opposition in the hearts of impenitent men, primarily went to the Jews first. Remember, Christ spoke to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Paul said in Romans 1:16 that the gospel went to the Jew first and then to the Greek or to the Gentile. So the message of Christianity went to Jewish hearers. We know that a clear gospel presentation does not normally engender happy reactions. So it's only natural that the Jewish authorities would react negatively against the gospel of Christianity. But second, the Jews who rejected the Messiah reacted strongly because Judaism, in its old covenant form, was in a real sense fulfilled and ended by the new covenant order. Unbelieving Jews who clung to the departing old covenant order out of a veneration for tradition most obviously were first to feel threatened by Christ's gospel and the church. We pointed out the fact of the centrality of the temple and temple worship. A third of the people in Jerusalem that lived there permanently were affiliated or associated with the temple. Christ says, I'm going to destroy the temple. Hey, we don't want this man's message. So they knew that the old covenant was ended. Now, it really ended, obviously, in 70 A.D. with the destruction of the temple. The Jewish opposition, we know from reading Acts, we can remember first with the stoning of Stephen, Paul going out to persecute the church, Paul converted. Then when Paul goes on his missionary journeys, we remember the many things that occurred to Paul. Is it 1 Corinthians 11 where Paul starts giving the list of the things that he has gone through, his shipwrecks, his beatings? One of the pastors was referencing Paul's beatings not too long ago, where I was hearing it somewhere. And just imagine his flesh being laid open with the Roman whip. And imagine when we have problems with infection today. I mean, we have hospitals that are supposed to be clean and they got Mercer in them and they've got, you know, how did Paul live through beatings like that? But he did. The church, through the book of Acts, we see mainly Jewish inspired and led persecution against the gospel message. The book of Acts pretty much takes us or focuses on Jewish-inspired persecution. Even after the destruction of the temple in 70 A.D., Jewish people in other areas brought pressure upon the church. When Polycarp was being persecuted, executed, it was Jewish authorities in that area who brought even attention and offered things for the destruction or for the persecution of Polycarp. Well, Jewish persecution up to about 60 A.D., but from 60 AD on, the persecution that the church really faced was persecution that came from Roman authorities. It's interesting in the book of Revelation that John talks about Rome being the great Babylon. We'll look at the verses later. You go through the book of Revelation and the persecution the church is experiencing, it's coming from Rome. Well, there's several things to remember about persecution by Rome. This went over the time period of about 60 AD up to around 320 AD. But remember this, the persecutions from Rome were sporadic. In this 250 or 60 year period, you had two very long periods in the third century of relative peace. Persecutions could break out at almost any time and in almost any place. But many Christians lived their lives in relative peace in the early centuries. Persecutions broke out sporadically in locales. In Lyon, in Gaul, in 177, I believe it was, there was persecution that killed Christians. In North Africa, in Carthage, in Asia Minor, in certain cities, there were persecutions that broke out. But it was not an empire-wide type of persecution. Until the middle of the third century, there was not systematic empire-wide persecution. As I said, North Africa, you had it. In Lyon, you had it. In Asia Minor, you had it. But you didn't have it in all the places at the same time. There are many wonderful accounts of Christians who were faithful through this period. We'll talk about a couple of them. A young believer named Perpetua, the Bishop Polycarp, the Bishop Ignatius. These were faithful. There were other Christians, unfortunately, who were not faithful. And it's a sad thing, but it's the thing we have to realize that not all will remain faithful through these persecutions. There is a book called The Flames of Rome by Dr. Paul Meyer, who is an ordained Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor and a professor of church history. Dr. Calhoun recommends this book. I have not read it, but he notes the fact that there's over 50 pages of footnotes in Dr. Meyer's book. This is really a historical novel, but it's a historical novel rooted in fact. So it's something that I'm intending to read, if the Lord lets me, before I teach this class in 2 more years. But I think it would be something that could be beneficial to read. But I just wanted to make you aware of that. Well, we need to ask the question, if there is Roman persecution, and there is, why were the Christians persecuted at all? Why? Wasn't Rome tolerant of religion? Remember, Rome allowed people to be religious. You had the mystery religions, you had the philosophies, you had ancestor worship, you had the pagan religions. All of these were allowed in the Roman Empire. They were, in a sense, permitted. I've put the Latin word, do you call it licita? I don't pronounce Latin, L-I-C-I-T-A. I'll just put it there. They were religions that were permitted. You had, at the same time, though, religions that were not permitted, licita. Now, what is the difference between a religion permitted and one not permitted? Judaism was permitted. Christianity was not. When Rome realized that Christianity was not a part of Judaism, then it became illegal. To begin with, Rome considered Christianity just a sect of Judaism. You had the Essenes, you had the Sadducees, the Pharisees, you had the it was something that occurred within Judaism. They were using the Judaic scriptures. They were going to the temple when they were allowed to. So, you know, it was a part of Judaism. But by the 60s, Rome realized that Christianity was different than Judaism. This caused them to determine and make Christianity illicita. Why? For this one reason: the exclusive truth claims of Christianity. You see, in Rome, in their idea, they had a syncretistic view of things. That Greek word means joined in alliance. All the religions work together. You know, you may work your way, you may work your way, but you work for the good of Rome. You work for the good of society. That is a contemporary statement, if there has ever been one, has it not? I mean, that is a contemporary statement. But what happened with Christianity? Christians and Jews both stood against this. But the Jewish religion was a historic religion. It was a religion identified with one people. It was a religion that was non-evangelistic. Jews did not proselytize Gentiles. You were born into Judaism. Guys were whacked. That's why you became a Jew. You were in it. It was a family thing. You could tell the thing. It was a nation. Even if it was dispersed, it was identified. So if you wanted to be the only one God, fine. But Christianity could never be that way. Why? The exclusive truth claims of Christianity. Ephesians 4:4-5. There is one body and one spirit, just as you were called to the one hope that belongs to your call, one Lord, one faith, one baptism. Boy, Paul's narrow-minded. I wonder where he got it from. Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Paul was codifying what his master had taught. Not only was it a religion that had exclusive truth claims, it was a religion that was evangelistic. Christianity, as we saw last week, went beyond national borders. It went beyond ethnic considerations. You had low-class, poor people in the church. You soon had ruling people in the church. You had people who served in the army in positions of authority in the church. You had people who served in Caesar's household who had become Christians. Christianity went and it broke barriers down. Yes, but it said there's one way. This was unacceptable to Rome. There could not be one way. There could not be one way. Well, what are some of the accusations that the Roman government made against Christians? It said, number one, that Christians were atheists. How could you be an atheist? You believed in God. Yeah, you did believe in God. But in Rome, you had to believe in all the gods, not one God. They worshipped, the Christians, one God who was invisible. They didn't even make a statue of him. You know, who was it? Who were they talking about? Obviously, they were atheists. It's interesting when Polycarp, well, we'll get to Polycarp later, but how the governor told him to talk about the atheist, and he did, and he looked to the whole crowd of people and said, behold, the atheist. Christians not only were atheists, Christians were immoral. Now, last week, we said that one of the things, or week before last, one of the things that was a complimented Christianity was the morality of the people, that they told the truth, they did right things. How could you call them to be immoral? Well, you see, there was certainly elements of immorality in Christianity. In fact, it was really yucky. They were cannibals. They ate flesh and drank blood. Yuck. I mean, can you get more immoral than that? They were guilty of incest. They had a holy kiss. They called everybody brother and sister. Bad. Rome was a very sexual city. If you were a Roman citizen, you were exposed to sexual themes. And when you heard of things, of people meeting in homes, at night, sharing a holy kiss with their brother and sister, if that did not speak of sexual immorality to you, you were not really a good Roman citizen. It's very understandable that what Christians did could be presented in a way that you immediately thought of that. As a sidelight, and I wondered whether to say this or not, but it's contemporary because of the radical agenda of the homosexual movement today. There are words that we can't even use, and there are phrases that when you hear them, or there are situations when you see them, you sometimes think of the worst. You shouldn't have to be that way, but it is things that kind of speak to you. I remember before we lost the business, I stopped referring to Ken as my partner. I called him my brother-in-law, or I would say my business partner. Because, you know, if you said your partner was coming to the city and would see someone, why? It's really, particularly when he had a beard, you know. And so it was terrible. It's terrible that sin so permeates society that that happens. But it is understandable, and it is understandable that some of these claims were laid against the early church. Well, not only were Christians atheists, not only were they immoral, but Christians were haters of humanity. Haters of humanity? What in the world are you talking about? Some said that you Christians are the cause of the disasters that are happening. This charge was a charge that was more and more level to the Christians in Rome. As Rome began to crumble, this was charged to them. People thought, we are strong. We were doing well till these Christians came in. Now look, the barbarians at our gate. St. Augustine wrote the City of God to answer these charges. Christians were blamed for almost anything that happened. Tertullian, the church father, says, if the Tiber reaches the walls, if the Nile does not rise to the fields, if the sky does not move so that there is drought, or if the earth does move so that there is an earthquake, if there is famine, if there is plague, the cry at once is, send the Christians to the lions. Tertullian is our best source of quotes. He puts things in words. But that was it. Any problem had to be because of these strange people who were not worshiping the Roman gods. Anyway, the Christians were haters of humanity. The Christians also were a threat to the government. Part of the Roman society was festivals, pageants, events, maybe July 4th celebrations. The Christians would not even come to July 4th. And you know why? Because in every Roman festival and every Roman holiday, there was a sexual element. There was sexual activity usually associated with Roman festivals and activities. And the Christians had to absent themselves from that because of that. It wasn't because that Rome was doing a pagan god. It was because of the immorality associated with the festivities. So let's don't take what I said there to think that we should absent ourselves from certain holidays because they may have bad origins. They were not absenting themselves from that. They were absenting themselves because of the immorality that was associated with these things. By the end of the 3rd century, Christians may have been persecuted simply because they were Christians. What does Peter write in 1 Peter 4:16? Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. They didn't have to be a real charge at this time. It just had to be the fact that they were Christians. One of the accounts that I think is so noteworthy was the account of the young girl, the young lady, the young mother, Perpetua. Perpetua was a young mother of 22 years old, approximately. She lived in the town of Carthage, which was in North Africa. She was a catechumen. A catechumen is someone that is studying to be a member of the church. It's almost like you're reading the 1689 in the church confession. If you're going to be a member, you need to know what you're joining. She was a catechumen. A persecution arose in the time of Septius Servius, who was emperor in 202. She was called in with the other catechumens. She was asked a question if she was a Christian. She could not do anything but admit that she was. So she was immediately, with the others, put in prison. She was separated from her infant son. Now, it says in the account of Perpetua that the deacons bribed the soldiers for better treatment. They didn't get them out of prison, but they got them to a better part of the prison where her son was able to be brought to Perpetua and she was able to nurse her son. We can imagine the agony that she was in being separated from her baby son. Note, I'll leave it that the deacons bribed them to get better treatment. They didn't bribe them to get out of prison. They just got better treatment for the ones in prison. Her baby was brought to her. She was able to nurse her baby. Her father comes to her and he pleads with her. "Daughter," he says, "have pity on my gray head. Have pity on your father if I deserve to be called your father. If I have favored you above all your brothers, if I have raised you to reach the prime of your life, do not abandon me to the reproach of men. Think of your brothers, think of your mother and aunt, think of your child, who will not be able to live once you are gone. Give up your pride. You will destroy all of us. None of us will be able to speak freely again if anything happens to you." What did she say to Dad? "It will all happen in the prisoner's dock as God wills, for you may be sure that we are not left to ourselves, but are all in his power." Perpetua said, when we're called to the prisoner's dock, which must be like a court situation before the ruler, whose name was, Hilarionus, he asked her, "Are you a Christian?" She said, "Yes." He said, "Have pity on your father's gray head. Have pity on your infant son. Offer the sacrifice for the welfare of the emperors." "I will not," she retorted. "Are you a Christian?" And I said, "Yes, I am." Well, at that point, they removed her. Her servant girl named Felicia, who was with her and who professed Christianity, they prepared for their execution. And they brought them into an arena. And it was very strange. They got a heifer, a female cow, must be grown, to charge these girls. Now, they brought them out, and they had stripped them naked and put them in a mesh bag that you could see through. And when the crowd saw that it was a young girl, Felicia, and a nursing mother, even the crowd said, "Clothe them." So they took them back, put a tunic on them that had a tie around the waist, and brought them back out. The heifer charged them, knocked them down, did not kill them. It was customary that the persecutions in these arena situations would go on for hours because the people were damaged, they were hurt, but they were not killed. Eventually, they took their bodies, as they would be broken, as legs would be broken, etc., they would move the bodies of the martyrs over to one side. Now, they would still be alive, and they would pile them there, and finally, at the end, the soldiers would come and would finish the job, would slit their throats. As the soldier came to Perpetua, it reported, that his hand was shaking so he could not put the sword to her. It is said that she reached up and took the sword and laid it to her own throat. It is a very sobering thing, but this is a true account. The observer who was writing says, "Ah, most valiant and blessed martyrs, truly you were called and chosen for the glory of Christ Jesus, our Lord." It's tough. One time her father was talking to her, and she said, "Father, do you see that vase?" He said, "Yes." She says, "You could no more call that vase a basket than you could call me anything but a Christian. The vase is a vase. I am a Christian." Good stories. Not legends. Real stories. Now, in this second and third century, you do have acts of martyrs recorded. And I think over time, some fanciful things have been added to some of these, and they sound so remarkable, you wonder if they happen. The historians that I read and respect believe that you really need to take away the fanciful stuff. The factual stuff is so often repeated that we know these things occurred. They may not have had quite the visions that was added to their revelation later, but these acts of martyrs certainly, certainly occurred. I spoke earlier of periods of calm. Well, if you had periods of calm, obviously you had periods of persecution. You could list out probably 8 or 9 periods of Roman persecution. I'll list out for us 6 or 7. The first period of persecution occurred under the reign of the Emperor Nero. You can read about it. If you have Dr. Gonzalez's book, he lays it out quite well. Nero had come to the throne in 54 AD. He was acceptable at first, but in the next 10 years, he managed to offend just about everyone in Rome. He really offended the poets and the artists because he acted like and wanted to be thought a poet and wanted to be thought an artist and wanted to be thought an actor. And they said, "You're a pretender." Well, in June of AD 64, in fact, on June 18th of AD 64, a fire broke out in the city of Rome. Nero was outside the city when it broke out. He rushed in, opened his gardens, led supposedly the efforts to fight the fire. The fire raged for 7 days and 6 nights. No, I had that reversed. It raged for 6 days and 7 nights. It burned 10 of the 14 quarters of the city were consumed by this fire. It burned sporadically for 3 more days after they thought they had it put out. Now, the rumor came up quite quickly that the emperor had set the fire. He was so full of himself that he thought he could rebuild Rome in a better way than it was built. We know from the writings of Tacitus, who was an eyewitness to these affairs, of what Nero said, what he did, what the people thought. And Nero turned the attention to the Christians, saying that were the Christians who did this. Allow me to read Tacitus. "In spite of every human effort, of the emperor's largesse, and of the sacrifices made to the gods, nothing sufficed to allay suspicion, nor to destroy the opinion that the fire had been ordered. Therefore, in order to destroy this rumor, Nero blamed the Christians, who are hated for their abominations, and punished them with refined cruelty. Christ, for whom they take their name, was executed by Pontius Pilate during the reign of Tiberius. Stopped for a moment, this evil superstition reappeared, not only in Judea, where the root of the evil was, but also in Rome, where all things sordid and abominable from every corner of the world come together. Thus, first, those who confessed that they were Christians were arrested, and on the basis of their testimony, a great number were condemned, although not so much for the fire itself as for their hatred of humanity." See, Tacitus knew that the Christians hadn't started the fire, but he was willing to report that they were considered haters of humanity for some of the reasons that we just talked about. Tacitus goes on, "Before killing the Christians, Nero used them to amuse the people. Some were dressed in furs to be killed by dogs. Others were crucified. Still others were set on fire early in the night so that they might illuminate. Nero opened his own gardens for these shows, and in the circus he himself became a spectacle, for he mingled with the people dressed as a charioteer, or he rode around in his chariot. All of this aroused the mercy of the people, even against these culprits who deserved an exemplary punishment. For it was clear that they were not being destroyed for the common good, but rather to satisfy the cruelty of one person." Dr. Gonzalez says, "Once again, the pagan historian, while showing no love for Christians, indicates that the reason for this persecution was not justice, but the whim of the emperor." It was a bloody time for a couple of years. It was probably the time that both Peter and Paul lost their life. Well, by 68, I think it was, the people were so fed up with Nero, and the Senate was so fed up with Nero that they deposed him, and he took his own life. This persecution, intense as it was really localized in Rome. It did not spread. Now, he issued an edict before his death that all Christians should be treated this way. This edict is referred to in ancient writings, but the edict itself cannot be found. Now, you can't discover the edict, but writers later referred back to this edict. But obviously, the edict was not acted upon. Second period of persecution from Domitian. Domitian, after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD, said, okay, he knew enough about Jewish history and Jewish ways to know that Jews paid big tithes to the temple, okay? Jews of the diaspora that were in all other areas that had not been killed because of the temple were still paying or had paid tribute. So he said, now you Jews pay tribute to me. The same amount that you'd been sending to Jerusalem for the temple support, you send to Rome. Some of the Jews complied. Soon, some opposed, and Domitian began a systematic persecution of Jews and Christians, both. He said that their actions were bad for Rome. He actually had, during from 94 to 96, during the time of his persecution, he executed a couple of members of the Roman nobility, one named Flavius Clemens, a lady named Domitilla. These are the only two names that we know from the period of persecution, but we know that this time was intense because it was during this time that John was exiled to the Isle of Patmos and he wrote the book of the Revelation. What does it say there? Then one of the seven angels who had seven bowls came and said to me, come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who was seated on many waters, and I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. Historically, John was probably thinking of Rome and this time of persecution when this was written. This was a time of intense persecution. Again, it didn't extend to the whole empire, but it was a time of intense persecution. Following Domitian, there was a good emperor, Trajan. It's interesting. Trajan, as I said, was a good emperor. Later, Marcus Aurelius was considered a good emperor. But persecution came from good emperors as well as bad. Nero, bad. Domitian, bad. Trajan, good. Marcus Aurelius, good. Persecution still came to the church. Trajan, Dr. Needham says, persecution came not so much from the emperors themselves as from governors of the empire's provinces and from a popular hatred of Christianity. Whenever we drink the Kool-Aid of deception that tells us that we can be so sweet and so kind and so helpful that the world will love us, we are drinking Kool-Aid, as strong as what Jim Johnson or Jones gave them in Guinea in that time. It is Kool-Aid. The world will not love Christians. We don't need to be contentious. We don't need to bring unnecessary, we don't need to be rude, and we don't want to be people like that. But if you're a consistent Christian, eventually the world will hate you. It has to, because it hated your Savior. And this was happening certainly in the time of Trajan. In the time of Trajan, we have the letters of Pliny, who was the ruler of Bithynia. And it's interesting from these writings what Pliny asked Trajan, and Trajan answered back on what to do with the Christians. They are, Trajan answered in one of his final things, they are to be hunted out, although any who are accused and convicted must, excuse me, may I begin again. They are not to be hunted out, Trajan says, although any who are accused and convicted must be punished, with the proviso that if any man says he is not a Christian and makes it obvious by his conduct, namely by worshiping our gods, then, however suspect he may have been with regard to the past, he should gain pardon from his repentance. Now, what could you do to gain pardon if you were accused of being a Christian? What could you do? Well, one of Rome's two goals in persecuting Christianity, Dr. Calhoun says, is to cause people to apostatize. That's what Trajan was saying to Pliny. Give them an opportunity. All you had to do was burn a little incense, eat a little meat that had been sacrificed to the idols, and then you could receive something. I didn't type it up here. A libelus, L-I-B-E-L-U-S. What is a libelus? A libelus is almost like a Social Security card. Everybody had to have one. This little card said, in my vernacular Southern English, I've sacrificed and I'm a good guy. Don't burn me. I mean, that's basically what the thing said. And you had two copies. One was to be put on file at City Hall or the Register of Deeds, and you were to keep one in your person. And there are extant copies of these available today. Extant means something still available that you can touch, read. And it says things in it. Let's see, I think I have the words here of what one said. Oh, well. I did have it, but I don't remember where it is. But in essence, it's saying that I, so-and-so, have sacrificed to the gods. And it didn't have to be a big thing. I'm talking about a little pinch of incense that you went over and dropped in the flame, and it poofed up. That was good enough to get your card. That's a small thing. That's a real small thing. And you're going to die because you're not going to burn that little bit of incense? Anyway, another reason for the Roman persecution was not to cause people to apostatize, but if they didn't apostatize, it was to martyr the obstinate. And that's what happened. If you refused to pay homage to the emperor, if you could not get this card when you were sought out and when you were identified, then you could be martyred. Ignatius, dear bishop, was martyred during this time of Trajan's reign. I don't have time to do him or go to him. Another period of persecution, Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius was a good emperor. He was a Stoic philosopher. But during the time of him, Polycarp was martyred. I have to gauge our time to be sure that we get to finish. Polycarp was bishop in Smyrna. Polycarp was born around A.D. 70. Ignatius tells us, Irenaeus says that whatever he heard from the eyewitnesses, he would relate to us. Polycarp bridged the time from the apostolic church to the early church. Polycarp was probably a disciple of John. He probably had heard the gospel and things greater than could be recorded from the disciple John himself. Polycarp bridged this, and Polycarp shared the truth with the people. Well, Polycarp was brought before the proconsul. He was arrested. He was moved outside to a farm. He said he had a vision that he would burn like a pillow. And he, before they removed him, they came to get him, and he said, "Let me pray for 2 hours." So the soldiers allowed him to pray for 2 hours before he was removed back to the city. He was brought before the proconsul, who was the only one who could preside over capital trials. The proconsul says, "Swear by the genius of Caesar, deny the atheist." Looking around, that's when Polycarp saw the crowds. He said, "Behold the atheist." What he was supposed to say. "Swear and I will release you," said the proconsul. And then the famous words of Polycarp, "86 years have I served him, and he has done me no wrong. How can I blaspheme my King who saved me? There are no more famous words from the period of the early church in someone pledging their allegiance to Christ and backing it up with their death. Bring the lines, he said. Get wood. The Jews helped the Gentiles. From this period, there was a pogrom in Gaul and France and Lyon. There were 48 Christians who were murdered in the amphitheater at one time. Another period after Marcus Aurelius is not a real period, but from the Severan dynasty, it's a time of relative peace. You had hot spots that broke out, like in Carthage in 202 when Perpetua and Felicitas was murdered. Bishops in major cities were required to give up their property. The scriptures, we know, came to be written in this period. The pogrom was against leaders of the church. Eusebius, who was a contemporary historian, writes about this. Origen wrote in this period. Origen had a period of relative calm, and we'll talk about Origen when we talk about the theologians of the church. Decius, from 249 to 251, instituted the period of the most grave threat to the church. This was the first persecution that literally was empire-wide. Now, Rome was under attack from the outside. The Christians were blamed for this. In fact, Decius blamed his predecessor, Philip, for being too weak on the Christians. He said that Decius was a conservative man. What do conservatives do? They return to their roots. He says, we are going to return to the worship of the Roman gods. Every year, people had to do sacrifices. Those who defied the authorities were arrested. The church recovered. There were some people who apostatized. And after Decius died, these people wanted to be let back in the church. What do you do with people who said, I'm sorry, I want to be let back in? How do you restore them? It causes a controversy that we'll talk about in a few weeks. William Friend has says the movement, the Novations, was a movement that came up at this time. Eusebius calls the Novations the pure. They would only let people in the church who had never apostatized or never done this. Their movement foreshadowed the more permanent division in the Christian church between those who put its integrity above all other values and those who regarded the universality of the Catholic part of the church as all important. And that's a controversy that goes on for centuries after this, is who do you view as members of the church. After Decius, you had Valerian. This was very intense persecution, but after Valerian's death, thankfully, you have a period of about 40 years of relative peace until the time of the great persecution of Diocletian from 303 to 312. We won't talk about that now. It would be too... I've got the notes on it, but I'll just tell you, there was persecution in the West. There was persecution in the East. You had different rulers or Caesars. Diocletian was the emperor, but you had Caesars under him, intrigue, and through the whole thing, the Christians came out the worst. This was the very most persecution that the church ever faced, was in this time. But in 312, Constantine became the ruler over an area and finally won his battle at Milvian Bridge and established the fact that religion, Christianity, was permitted, not endorsed, but permitted from 313 on in the Western Church. The Eastern Church, the persecutions continued to about 320 until Constantine got control over that. When Christianity becomes permitted, later it becomes the official religion of Rome, you have something that occurs that will always be a problem in the church, and that is nominalism. When the church is the place to be, everybody wants to be in the church, then how do you judge the people by behavior and by action that are in the church? That's always a tension and a question. Hey, it's a tension and a question in 2007. That is the year we're in. If I can't remember the year, how do I know what I'm talking about? But anyway, but it's a question today. It's always going to be a question. Where do you put barriers? Where do you put walls? Where do you put fences? What do you do? We have to operate in love and grace, but in truth. What are the results of the persecution? There's two specific results. No doubt that persecution purified the church. F.F. Bruce, in his book called The Spreading Flame, said that Christianity was organized for catastrophe. What did he mean by that? He meant that the church knew that persecution would come. The founder of the church was persecuted and crucified. He had said that the servant is no better than the master. If the Lord had told the church that persecution would come, should not the church be prepared for it? And so that's why Bruce said, the church, Christianity, was organized for catastrophe. It knew it would come, it knew it could come, and to a large degree, it withstood it. The church and Christians were prepared to die. Sometimes the problem came up that they were too prepared. Some people wanted to rush to martyrdom. Origen, who I mentioned earlier, who proved to be a very beneficial theologian of the church, Origen's father was being taken to be martyred. Origen, as a young man, probably a teenage boy, wanted to go with his dad. That's admirable. His mother hid his clothes. He would have had to go out stark naked, which he wouldn't go out stark naked. This saved Origen's life. Origen was useful for the church later. It was good that he did not follow voluntarily his father to martyrdom. One of the early church fathers said in writing to the church, if you are brought before authorities, do not deny Christ. Die like a Christian. But do not try to be persecuted. Do not try to be martyred. It's a big difference. It's a big difference. Do not try to be obstinate today. Do not try to fly in the face of authorities today. They'll find you out soon enough and you will have an opportunity to stand for righteousness. You don't have to be strange and be a square peg in a round hole so that they automatically see you. That's not what it means to be prepared to stand for Christ. Persecution, though, purified the church. Persecution extended, if I can turn my last page, extended the church. Over and again, Tertullian says in his famous quote, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. There are multiple stories of the faithful witness of Christians. There's the story of the 40 martyrs of Sebaste or Sebaste. If you read that story in Gonzales, he talks about these 40 martyrs who were taken out on a frozen lake to spend the night, and they were going to be martyred the next day. They were singing during the night. One leaves their number and goes to the safe, warm bathhouse. So there were 39 left. But the jailer who had been watching them was so impressed by their integrity and their willingness to die for Christ that he took his clothes off and he walked out on the ice to join them again. And the 40 martyrs were martyred for the cause of Christ. The witness of the church was effective. Now, I've not always taught this because I haven't always thought about this, but persecution did not always extend the church. There were times that persecution crushed the church in certain areas. Dr. Moffat in his History of the Christianity of Asia says, sharp persecution breaks off the tips of the branches. It produces martyrs, and the tree still grows. Never-ending social and political repression, on the other hand, starves the roots. It stifles evangelism, and the church declines. So there are periods of persecution that lead to the diminishing of the witness of the church. Not because the people were not faithful, but because the authorities under God's providence were giving such freedom that they pressed the church so far down. But even in those situations, do we not have a promise from our Lord that trumps it all, that he will build his church? Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Thank you for your time and attention.